campus who have a broad interest in entrepreneurial curriculum. More information can be found at www.ael.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be talking about Germany and politics there. After a deadlock, a political deadlock that lasted 3 weeks, the announcement was made yesterday that Germany has a new leader. Angela Merkel, a former academic physicist, will be taking the place of Gerhard Schröder to become Germany's first female chancellor. She is also the first to hail from the former East Germany. We'll talk this morning about the recent elections, what happened to produce this virtual tie between the two parties that got the most votes, and why it is that we have the outcome that we do, what that means for German politics, and perhaps also what that means for the relationship between Germany and the United States. All of that in this part of the show as we talk with Karen Donfried. She is Senior Director for Policy Programs at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. She has served as the fund's director of foreign policy. She also had for a time a position in the State Department. That's from fall of 2003 through May of 2005. She handled the Europe portfolio on the policy planning staff in the Office of Secretary of State. She also served as the Marshall Fund's director of foreign policy and before that worked as a European affairs specialist in the Foreign Affairs, Defense, and Trade Division of the Congressional Research Service. She's written many articles and reports for the Congress on German foreign and defense policy, also on European integration and transatlantic relations. She is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations and the American Council on Germany, and she's talking with us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions from listeners are certainly welcome. The only thing we ask of people is that they try to be brief so we can keep the program moving, get in as many people as possible. But anybody who's listening is welcome to call. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's the telephone number to use. If you are anyplace else, and it would be a long-distance call for you around Illinois or Indiana. Also, in fact, if you'd be listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the U.S., you may use the toll-free line that we have. That's 800-222-9455. So, again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Donfried, hello.
Hello. Good morning.
Well, thanks for talking with us today.
My pleasure.
We appreciate it. Maybe before talking about this, how it is that there was this political deadlock between the two parties, the Christian Democrats and the Social Democrats, I might ask you to talk a little bit about the atmosphere before the election. In fact, to talk about why the election happened at all, because the chancellor, Mr. Schröder, called the elections a year ahead of schedule. So obviously he felt that there was something going on that he needed to demonstrate the strength of his party and its support.
It was a surprise to most of us that Gerhard Schröder, the sitting chancellor, called early elections. What happened is in May of this year, there was a very important state election. It was a state that the Social Democrats, Schröder's party, have governed for decades. And the SPD lost that state election. And Schröder, as a result, decided that he had lost the confidence of his party and of his countrymen, and therefore he should call elections a year early. This was surprising to many of us because Schröder is a very deft politician. And the economic reforms that the Social Democratic Green coalition government had put into place were likely to start showing an impact next year. So people thought he would be better poised to wait and run for re-election as he should have done next fall. But it seems that his calculation was that if he called early elections, he would cause the opposition Christian Democrats, Angela Merkel's party, to be caught off guard. And as we saw over the past months, Schröder is a master campaigner and did draw very close in support to the CDU. So it may have been a gambit that at some level paid off for him.
Mm-hmm. One of the questions that I wonder is the results in the election, the two top vote getters were the Christian Democrats, that's Ms. Merkel's party, and the Social Democrat, that's Mr. Schröder's party. And while the Christian Democrats got more votes and got more seats, the difference between the two parties, the Christian Democrats and Social Democrats was so small that apparently that Mr. Schröder felt that he was in a position to stake a claim to continuing to be chancellor and to lead the what would be the inevitable coalition. And I guess here the question I'm going for is, did Mr. Schröder really think that there was a chance that he could hang on as chancellor? Or was this, again, a kind of negotiating strategy that he was trying to get the best possible deal as he could for his party? And it seems that, and we can talk a little bit about what the deal was, that he actually did indeed get quite a good deal, even though he will not be the chancellor. Did he really think that he could hang on?
It was interesting. In the immediate wake of the election, there is always a television round table that includes the leaders of the various parties. And in that television session, Schröder came out very strong in saying that the election results showed that on the question of whom Germans wanted to be chancellor, he had clearly won. And that was why he was claiming that he should remain chancellor, even in a grand coalition government, a grand coalition being a coalition between those two big center-right and center-left parties. Now, the reason he claimed that is because when he called early election, and in the ensuing months, Angela Merkel and her party were clearly in the lead. At one point, they had a 20 percentage point lead over Schröder and his Social Democrats. What we ended up with on Election Day on September 18th was a very close finish between these two parties, with the CDU-CSU squeaking ahead just by one percentage point. And you're right, in the parliament, in the Bundestag, the CDU-CSU only have four more seats, 226 seats to 222 seats for Schröder Social Democrats. So Schröder said, the fact that I was able to swallow that huge lead that Angela Merkel had shows my own popularity. But what happened over the past 3 weeks up to this announcement yesterday was the reality that the CDU-CSU was the largest party in the new parliament, even if only by one percentage point. And that's why the Christian Democrats said the one non-negotiable point for us is that we get to pick the chancellor, and that chancellor will be Angela Merkel. Schröder then quite effectively used that to get a pretty good deal for the Social Democrats in this coalition government, where power will really be split pretty much 50-50 between the parties. So I think part of him did want to stay on and govern, but then the political reality set in, and he used that opening position of extreme self-confidence to bargain for the best deal he could get for his party.
Hmm. Seems that one of the interesting questions here is that what happened to Angela Merkel's support that, as you point out, early on in the run-up to the election, it was thought that there would be no question that it would be a decisive victory for her and for the Christian Democrats, and that as you get closer and closer to the election, her support begins to erode. And though, as you say, there was a slight edge for the Christian Democrats, that was a remarkable comeback for Mr. Schröder. What happened that early support for Ms. Merkel seemed to slip away?
I think there are two factors at play there. One has to do with the personality of the two individuals running for chancellor. Schröder is in many ways the consummate politician. He is well-liked by much of the German public. He's articulate. He's charismatic, telegenic. And those are all things that Angela Merkel is still learning. She is not a natural politician. She's closed. She's guarded. Certainly the fact that she's a woman and a woman from the eastern part of the country, the formerly communist part of the country, is a part of this as well. But this particularly came into focus in early September when the two candidates had a televised debate. And it would seem that most Germans came away from that debate feeling that Schroeder was better suited to be chancellor. So one issue was that personality question. The second issue had to do with policy competence. Angela Merkel, in this campaign, hit very hard the issue of economic reform, saying that the overriding issue that a new government had to deal with was Germany's stagnant growth and Germany's extremely high unemployment of about 5 million people. Now, that message was coming through quite clear until she announced that part of her economic team was going to include a professor from Heidelberg, as he's been called, a man, Professor Kirchhoff, and he then entered the scene and advocated a flat tax, which is not something Angela Merkel had been proposing. And the Social Democrats, Schröder's party, seized on this issue to say, ah, look at what the Christian Democrats are really planning. They want to put in place a flat tax that will lead to nurses being taxed at the same level as millionaires. Do you really want this? And the ensuing debate led to an extreme muddling of Merkel's message on the economy. So then you also had German voters saying, gosh, maybe we wouldn't be in a better spot with a CDU government, with an Angela Merkel-led government. So it was both personality and policy that came back to bite her.
Hmm. Well, it also seems that when you have these two parties, the Christian Democrats and their allies and the Social Democrats, coming in a virtual tie, almost as close as you could get to a tie, that would suggest that among the German people there were a lot of mixed feelings about where the country was, where the country should be going, and how to get there.
Well, and this has provided a lot of grist for the analysis mill. There are some people who look at this and say, ah, but even though it was such a close result, 80% of Germans voted for parties advocating economic reform. Namely, they voted for the Social Democrats, the Christian Social Union, and the Free Democrats. And that's 80% of your electorate. So they do want reform. I look at those results and say, I think Germans are deeply ambivalent about the extent to which they want economic reform. And at the end of the day, they were scared off by the CDU message that the scale and pace of economic reform should be picked up. So I come down saying that, yes, there is deep ambivalence in the German public about the extent to which they want to see real reform and see their own benefits cut back.
Let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last 5 or 10 minutes, talking with Karen Donfried. She is Senior Director for Policy Programs at the German Marshall Fund of the United States and has been following German politics for some time now, written a lot on German foreign and defense policy, on transatlantic relations. And we're talking about Germany and the recent elections there. It took place a couple of weeks ago. And this long standoff, what came to be called the Battle of the Chancellors in the German media, where the former chancellor, Gerhard Schröder, and the woman who now will be chancellor, Angela Merkel, both claimed the right to put together a coalition and become the next chancellor. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit more about Ms. Merkel. And as I said at the beginning of the program, there are a couple of firsts associated with her. She will be the first woman to be chancellor, and also the first German who grew up in the former East Germany to be chancellor. And I wonder, in the minds of Germans, which of those two firsts is the more significant, the first woman or the first Easterner?
I think both are extremely significant. Her personal story is a fascinating one. You know, she was born in the western part of the country, and her father was a Protestant minister who was then called to a parish in the eastern part of the country, and he moved his family there. So it's a very unusual way to end up being or growing up in Eastern Germany. She was not political in her youth, not surprisingly. I mean, she was growing up in communist East Germany. She studied physics. She became a scientist. And it was only with the fall of the wall and German unification that she became involved in politics. And she was very much a protege of Helmut Kohl, who was, of course, the German chancellor under which the country was unified. And interestingly, when Kohl and others close to him became involved in a financial scandal, even though she was seen as his protege, she was one of the first people in the party to stand up and say his time was over and a new generation of leaders needed to stand up within the Christian Democrats. She then very skillfully was able to solidify power within the party, lead the party, and now be its chancellor candidate. So she clearly has a very keen sense of power. Now, how she's viewed in the country, it's interesting. One might think that she would be popular among Eastern Germans, given her heritage, but it seems that many Eastern Germans view her more as a professional politician than as someone necessarily who represents their interests. And Eastern Germany tends to be heavily Protestant and tends to vote more for the Social Democrats than the Christian Democrats. And you didn't see a big turn to Merkel by Easterners in this election. It's also not clear that women in particular were voting for her. So she's a very interesting character in that she has broken this barrier, first woman chancellor from the East. But the obvious constituencies are not there for her among those groups.
Mm. Well, one of the interesting things that in the number of the articles that I read about her suggested that it may be difficult for her or had been difficult for her to gain acceptance on both sides of that dividing line because in the West, the West Germans looked at her and saw a former East German, but the East Germans looked at her and saw someone who maybe looked suspiciously to them like a West German. So somehow each side had a way of looking at her and seeing the other, which would suggest that it would be difficult for her on both sides of that dividing line to gain widespread acceptance.
No, you're right. That has been very much the way she's been viewed, and she faces a real challenge now to be able to be a leader for the whole country. And it was interesting yesterday when it was announced that the parties had agreed on the basis for starting formal coalition negotiations, she did not crack a smile during her press statement. And she was then asked by a journalist, "How do you feel? Do you feel good?" And she allowed herself to say, "Yes, you know, I am feeling positive, but there's a lot of work ahead of me." And I think she really is now feeling the burden of expectations and also the burden of the many serious problems Germany faces both politically and economically.
One of the things that I have found very interesting in, again, what I have read about her is that how often people compare her to Margaret Thatcher, and at the same time, people will come along and say, "Well, no, she's really not like Margaret Thatcher." Is there, in fact, any basis for making a comparison between Angela Merkel and Margaret Thatcher?
It is very appealing, and there are people who've coined the phrase that she's Maggie Merkel. I think they like the alliteration of that. But the reality is that the differences far outweigh the similarities. You know, if you look beyond the fact that there are women leaders of major European countries, first, you know, Thatcher did not govern in a coalition, and the United Kingdom has never been a social welfare state in the way Germany is. So the chance that you would have the sort of radical economic reform in Germany under Angela Merkel that you saw in the UK under Maggie Thatcher, it's just not possible. And it is certainly not possible when Angela Merkel is the head of a grand coalition in which the two key parties are so close in representation in the cabinet. There are going to be tremendous constraints on her ability to put in place economic reform. And my sense is the best we can hope for is a continuation of the modest economic reforms that Schröder was putting in place during his chancellorship.
Perhaps we could talk a little bit more about the deal that Mr. Schröder managed to get for the Social Democrats. They will, in this grand coalition, apparently have 8 of 14 ministries, and those will include the Ministry of they'll get to name the Finance Minister and also the Foreign Minister of Foreign Affairs, which seemed to me to be two of the more significant posts, particularly, and also labor. If your prime concerns are economic, and also something else we'll talk about, I want to make sure we talk about at some point here, and I'm sure we will, the relationship between Germany and the United States. But that would make it sound like, even though, as we discussed, Mr. Schröder had something of a comeback, he could spin that so he could say, well, yes, we didn't win, but just look at the turnaround in support for the two parties. Having said that, he got to the point where he knew that the proverbial writing was on the wall. He would not be the chancellor. But he did, sounds as if to me, that he worked out a very, very good deal for his own party in terms of the amount of power and influence the Social Democrats will continue to have.
Right. That is very true. What was announced yesterday was the basis for formal coalition negotiations to begin on Monday, this coming Monday. And the parties released basically a 2.5-page document that stated their desire to begin these formal coalition negotiations. And in that document, it was outlined which parties would get which positions. So the Christian Democrats take the chancellorship, and that's why Angela Merkel stepped forward and said, that's me. Mm-hmm. And they also, therefore, have the ministry post in the chancellor's office. So they had those two, and then they took another 6 substantive ministries. So the CDU and its sister party, the Christian Social Union, will also have the economics ministry, the interior ministry, the defense ministry, family and seniors, education and research, and consumer protection. The Social Democrats get a total of 8 ministries. As you said, the Foreign Ministry, Finance Ministry, Justice, Economic Cooperation and Development, Employment, Health, Traffic, and Environment. And the crown jewels there for the Social Democrats are the Foreign Ministry and the Finance Ministry. So what you'll have sitting around that cabinet table are 8 folks on each side of that divide. So there is true parity of representation. Now, you could say, well, the chancellor is first among equals. I mean, she clearly has a special role. But any contentious decisions that come down the path, you are going to need cooperation and agreement across these party lines. Now, the interesting question that we don't know the answer to is who is going to take these positions. The only thing we know is that Edmund Stoiber, who is the head of the Christian Social Union, the sister party of Merkel's Christian Democratic Union, will be the economics minister. But we don't, for example, know who will be vice chancellor. And some in the Social Democrats have said, Schröder should be vice chancellor. I can't imagine it. I can't imagine, having watched Schröder over these past 3 weeks, that he would ever be willing to play second fiddle to Angela Merkel.
Well, and he, in all of the stories that I have read so far, and you know, politics, never say never in politics, have said that he said that he will not have a role in the new government, and various and sundry quotes saying something to the effect of, I've got other stuff I want to do. He will pursue other interests, and you know, it's sort of hard to imagine that someone having been chancellor for 7 years and having been such an important force in German politics that he would just go and spend the rest of his time fishing or
well, we
something
have
like that.
Wonderful direct quotes from him on this. I mean, there had been speculation about whether he might play this role of vice chancellor and foreign minister, which is the role Joschka Fischer has played in his government. And he said, I take that as a personal insult. But also, even before the election, he had said, I am running either for victory or for Victoria. Now, obviously, he wasn't victorious. He will not be chancellor. So he may well choose to spend more time with his daughter, Victoria.
We are talking this morning in this part of Focus 580 with Karen Donfried. She is the Senior Director for Policy Programs at the German Marshall Fund of the United States. She has also served as the fund's Director of Foreign Policy. She worked as European Affairs Specialist in the Foreign Affairs, Defense, and Trade Division of the Congressional Research Service, and also had a post in the State Department. From fall of 2003 through May of 2005, she handled the Europe portfolio on the policy planning staff in the Office of the Secretary of State. And she has written many articles and reports for Congress on German foreign and defense policy, on European integration, also on transatlantic relations. And we're talking a bit about German politics, about the recent election, and questions are welcome. And in fact, we have someone standing by here ready to go. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to join the conversation, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number. It's 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here in Urbana to start us off. Line one. Hello.
Good morning. I'm calling to ask for a little backing up, if you could. Each major party probably has their explanation for why the German economy is in its current state, and of course what to do about it. But is there a consensus either in Europe or across here in the United States for why the German economy wound up where it did, as opposed to the U.S. economy, which went really wild in the 90s and even now is coming back? Could you address how this happened, please?
Sure. Hello? I think there... Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Yes. We've got your question. All right. Go ahead.
Thank you very much for that. I think there are a couple of different reasons that economists point to for why the German economy is in the state it is today. One reason certainly is German unification and the fact that for 15 years now, very large subsidies have been going from the western part of the country to the eastern part of the country to have parity across that line. Some people point to the original decision that was made by Helmut Kohl when he was chancellor to cash in the East German marks at a 1-to-1 ratio with the West German mark. So there are a lot of issues relating to unification that help explain why the German economy has not been growing for a period of time. The other reason that many people point to has to do with the rigidity of labor markets in Germany. For example, it's once you've hired someone, very difficult to fire them. There are very heavy social benefits that go along with any hiring. So many of the economic reforms that are being talked about now in Germany are looking precisely at that issue of how to make the labor market more flexible. The hope being that if you took away some of those rigidities, you would encourage employees to hire more individuals and therefore bring down that very high unemployment rate in Germany.
Does that yes, go
care? Does that go through employers rather than through the single payer central state?
Well, there are going to be some, I mean, obviously some very major German companies right after the German election announced layoffs. So there are many measures that companies themselves are taking. But the question is, what is imposed by the federal government in terms of the regulations that companies have to go by?
Some of what you said sounds short term, that once the East and West were reintegrated, once debts and all were paid off, it could take off again. Is
right.
That what one or another party has argued? Give us some little bit more time to get this debt under control, and then we'll take off again.
Well, that certainly is the hope, but we're now in year 15, and we're still seeing those payments go from west to east. The interesting thing, if you look at Germany, is what we now see as an east-west split traditionally has been a north-south split, with the southern part of Germany being the industrialized part and northern Germany tending to be more agricultural. And I think we're starting to see that north-south split reassert itself. So you have a couple of the states in what was formerly East Germany doing quite well, Thuringia, Saxony, but the northern part simply isn't taking off. And I mention that because if you also look at the electoral map of Germany, you'll notice that the southern part of the country voted overwhelmingly for the Christian Democrats and the Christian Social Union, and the northern part of the country voted for the Social Democrats. So sort of that top half of the map is red and the bottom half is black. And I think that also gives us a sense of support within Germany for economic reforms that will reduce benefits Germans currently get.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for the call. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. At this point, maybe I'll ask you to talk a little bit about the relationship between Germany and the United States. Certainly has been strained recently because Mr. Schröder came out in opposition to the United States and the Bush administration's war in Iraq, which definitely strained relations between Germany and the United States. Ms. Merkel seemed to be much more sympathetic to the United States and to the Bush administration. But given the fact that the Minister of Foreign Affairs is going to be a member of the Social Democrats, Mr. Schröder's party, one just wonders what exactly is going to change in the relationship between Germany and the United States, if anything does.
I think something will change. At least the style and rhetoric of the German chancellor will change. It is fair to say that the relationship between Chancellor Schröder and President Bush was fatally damaged by the very public falling out over the Iraq war. That is not to say that Berlin and Washington have not been working extremely closely on a whole host of issues, from Afghanistan to the Balkans. And even on Iraq, Germany is very engaged. There, Germans are training Iraqi soldiers outside of Iraq and doing a host of other things. But it's been very difficult to manage differences of opinion because of the fact that these two heads of state at this point do not have a close relationship, do not really trust each other. And even in this election, Schröder used the anti-American card from time to time, kept stressing that, you know, German foreign policy will be made in Berlin, and I'm not going to send German soldiers off on adventures in other places. Now, Angela Merkel certainly will not use that sort of language, and I think style and rhetoric do matter in a relationship. I do not think you'll see fundamental changes in policy. Certainly Angela Merkel is not going to send German troops to be part of that coalition in Iraq. But I think on other issues, you will see more shared policy. I'm thinking here of something like the European Union's arms embargo on China, where Chirac and Schröder, the French president, together with Gerhard Schröder, had been the major boosters within the European Union of lifting that arms embargo on China. The Bush administration had very strongly opposed that move, fearing it would negatively impact the strategic balance in the Taiwan Straits. I think on an issue like that, a government led by Angela Merkel will be more supportive of U.S. policy. And I think, yes, we'll have a Social Democratic foreign minister, but my sense is that foreign minister will not be Gerhard Schröder. So I don't think that individual will carry any baggage from that public falling out over Iraq.
We talked a little bit earlier about Ms. Merkel's background and about one of the significant firsts, in addition to being the first woman chancellor, is that she's the first chancellor to hail from the former East Germany. And also talked about the fact that she is perhaps having a little bit of a difficult time bridging that old East-West divide, in the sense that it seems that no one on the two sides completely trusts her, the Easterners or the Westerners, which goes to the question of unification and to what extent Germany is still a divided country.
Well, you know, this is not my line, but I think it's an apt line that while the country is unified, Germans are still divided in their heads, that maybe it's one country, but it's not one nation. And what's striking about that, of course, is that this year we're celebrating the 15th anniversary of unification. And I think many Germans are surprised that it has taken this long to really have the sense of one nation. And you still see the splits when you look at election results. For example, the former Communist Party of East Germany renamed itself the Party of Democratic Socialism, the PDS. And in 1990, most analysts thought that that party would die out relatively quickly. And instead, we've seen that the PDS was able to have pretty solid support over the ensuing 15 years. And what happened in this election was that the Party of Democratic Socialism formed an alliance with a break-off from the Social Democrats, led by Oskar Lafontaine, who interestingly had been Schröder's finance minister in the first Schröder term before Lafontaine resigned in disagreement. So you have this new left party, Party of Democratic Socialism, together with a splinter of the Social Democrats, that did very well in this election. And the speculation now is that this new left party, the Party of Democratic Socialism, has really anchored itself as a regional party in the same way that the Christian Social Union is sort of a Bavarian, a regional party of Bavaria. You now sort of have a regional party in the eastern part of the country. And it shows the failure of the two big parties to reach out to those Easterners and really pull them into the existing polity. So it remains a big challenge for Germans, and it will be interesting to see if Angela Merkel can use her background and intimate knowledge of the East to make a contribution to really unifying the country.
Let's talk with another listener, someone in Charleston, and this is line number 4. Hello.
Yes, two questions. First, can your guest extrapolate what is going to happen to the German working class?
Well, that's a big question. Can you say something about that, Dr. Donfrey?
That is a big question. And I'm not sure quite what angle you're coming at that from, but it actually follows on very nicely on this comment I was making about the new left party. Because what we've seen is a splintering of the political left in Germany. And that would be, of course, the part of the political spectrum that traditionally has been seen as representing the working class. The Social Democrats, I mean, the first split really came in the late 70s, early 80s, when the Greens formed a new party. And that further splintering came this year with the new party, the new left party involving Oskar Lafontaine and that break-off element of the Social Democrats. And what that has meant is that while you have majority support, if you add up those people who voted for the Social Democrats, the Greens, and the New Left, you would say, okay, that's a pretty impressive percentage of the German public. But because the Social Democrats and the Greens have said emphatically they will not cooperate with the New Left Party because it includes former communists, you do not have a governing majority of the left. And I think that's a challenge for the working class in Germany, because how do they ensure that their concerns are represented in government? And I think it will be interesting to see how this new left party develops over time and where the labor unions, not just where the labor unions store their support, but where labor union members give their votes. So I think we are seeing something interesting happening on the political plane in Germany that does have implications for how the working class is able to articulate its political views.
Well, it appears to me that there's 11,000 Mercedes-Benz Chrysler workers are going to be out on their ear. My second question is, given the historic failures of the last 200 years and the progress of capitalism on the lives of every person on this planet, and the failures that have come from that, witnessing what's happening at Morocco as we speak, and the neglect of the masses of humanity by the very people that you have been articulating the history of, how is it possible that this paradigm of capitalist entrepreneurialism, what a word, is somehow going to cure the ills of humanity? Do you have any idea about the snail's progress and the corrupt goings-on of those who, the bourgeoisie in particular, that own everything, and everybody else is trailing along as if there's going to be a tomorrow under this system, and there is not? Can you say anything about that?
Well, that's certainly one perspective on where the world is heading. Another perspective, which might be a little more optimistic, is that if you look at the European continent over the past 15 years since German unification, you have seen the spread of greater freedoms and democracies to countries east of Germany. And Germany's played a very important role in that as well. You now have a European Union that includes 25 member countries. We had an expansion of the EU last year by 10 that brought in 8 formerly communist countries of Central and Eastern Europe. You now see democratic changes in, you know, what we talk about as wider Europe, in places like Georgia, places like Ukraine. So you certainly can look at the world and see the glass is half empty. You can also look at some of these developments and say, well, there is positive change happening in some places. That doesn't mean there's a lot more to do, but I think it's maybe a little bit more of a mixed picture from where I sit.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus. We'd welcome other calls if people have questions. And again, I should introduce our guest, Karen Donfrey. She is Senior Director for Policy Programs at the German Marshall Fund of the United States and has been following German politics for quite some time. She also, for a time between the fall of 2003 and May of 2005, had a post in the U.S. State Department where she handled the Europe portfolio on the policy planning staff in the Office of Secretary of State. She also has worked for the Congressional Research Service as European Affairs Specialist in the Foreign Affairs, Defense, and Trade Division. And questions welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. There's something that I'm interested in having you talk about that, and you just touched just a moment ago on EU expansion, something now that seems to be roiling European politics just a bit, and that is the debate over the admission of Turkey to the EU, something that the talks have been going on for some time now, and there and now officially they've said they're going to start officially talking about Turkey joining. It's destined to be a long process, so that it will take some time. And there has been opposition. There has been a lot of opposition in Austria, and apparently Ms. Merkel said that she was opposed to Turkey joining the EU. First of all, perhaps I guess I would ask the question, does the fact that now she will be chancellor, does that will that have some impact on this whole process, or the fact that the talks have now started and it will take a long time, does it really mean much one way or the other?
I think given that the talks did in fact start, it was October 4th, they ought to have started on October 3rd, but there were several last-minute crises that meant the talks only began right after midnight. So the fact that those talks have started makes it, I think, a much less politically salient issue. You're right that Angela Merkel does not support full membership for Turkey in the European Union. Her position and that of the majority of her party has been supportive of a privileged partnership for Turkey with the European Union, something short of full membership. That said, Merkel was clear that she would not oppose decisions that had already been reached. I think what she was referring to there was the decision last December by the European Union member states to begin accession negotiations with Turkey this October. Now, I think that said, Turks were probably somewhat relieved by the inconclusive German election result. They didn't mind that it took 3 weeks for this to get sorted out, because it meant that there was not a new German government in place to make any statement about the start of those talks on October 3rd, 4th. Now, going forward, I imagine that Merkel will continue to say that she does not support full membership for Turkey, which puts her in opposition certainly with U.S. policy. But given that these accession negotiations are likely to last 10 to 15 years, we will not be at a decision point for a long time. Mm. So there's not something in the short term that she will have to decide on that could cause this to be a contentious issue across the Atlantic, or for that matter, within Europe.
I think that this is a very interesting story, and I guess because on both sides, there are a lot of people who are wrestling with the idea of what is – well, and for example, on the Turkish side, I think a lot of people are wrestling with this idea of what is Turkey and where does it fit in Europe? Does it fit in Europe? Where – and that there is this tug, in a sense, that people in Turkey feel this strong tug between the East and the West, and they're working on trying to resolve what their identity is. And I suppose this, in a sense, the same kind of thing is happening in Europe as Europeans are starting to think about Europe and where its important connections lie and how it reaches out and forms connections and relationships outside of the traditional sort of boundaries. I'm interested in having you talk about how Europeans are thinking about this, and does it indeed say something about Europeans wrestling with this notion of what it means, not just what it means to be German or to be French or to be an Austrian or to be Italian or whatever, but is there in some sense that they are in a part of some larger polity, and what exactly that is?
Yes. Absolutely. There is a conversation in Europe taking place in every country about what is Europe's identity, what is Europe. Many Europeans are still trying to come to terms with last year's enlargement by 10. There's never been an enlargement of the European Union by 10 countries at once. So that very much changed the perspective of the European Union. And we saw the self-doubt that this has caused for many Europeans in some of the votes on the new European Constitution. There were referenda in France and in Netherlands in late May, early June on this European Constitution. And in France and the Netherlands, majority of the citizens voted no on the European Constitution. And those no votes were broadly interpreted as showing the sense of unease that French and Dutch have about the direction the EU is taking. And in part, that sense of unease was occasioned by this enlargement process and by the specter of Turkish membership. I want to say there were a lot of other reasons that caused that no vote. It had to also do with domestic governments that were not popular. It had to do with the fact that many Dutch and French felt the euro had brought with it inflation. So it wasn't just about enlargement and about Turkey, but that was a piece of understanding those no votes. And many Europeans, when they look to Turkey, they say, look, you know, Turkey is just too big, too poor, and too Muslim to join the European Union. Today, Germany is the largest country in the EU, but if you look at demographic trends 15 years down the road, Turkey would likely be the largest EU member state. So there is a difference that Turkish membership would bring that would make it different from any other enlargement. But we have to remember that 15 years from now, Turkey will be a different country than it is today. Turkey has been on this path since 1963. It was in 1963 that Turkey first signed an association agreement with the then European Community. So for 40 years, Turkey has been trying to deepen its relationship to the European Union. So for Turkey, this was a huge success, opening these negotiations this month. What it means for Turkey is that for the next 10 to 15 years, Turkey will stay on a reform path that has already brought about political, social, and economic changes to Turkey. You know, Turkey's now recognizing the cultural integrity of Kurds. They've abolished the death penalty. They've put in place judicial reforms. And Turkey will continue to make reforms like that during this process of membership negotiations. So 15 years from now, it'll be a different Turkey, and frankly, it will be a different European Union. So I think it's very hard today to say it doesn't make sense for Turkey to join the EU. It may well make sense 15 years down the road.
We're very short on time. I do want to try to accommodate one more caller here quickly in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to ask, just a postscript, say that this grand coalition, it's going to be a total train wreck, it seems to me. I don't think it's going anywhere. Just a distribution of portfolios, the fact that you have these other parties like the Greens and the New Left Party, there's got to be some sympathy in back. This is comparable to Blair's situation with backbenchers, SDP people who think this is a ridiculous thing to do, and that they could have peeled off some people from the New Left and had a party that, but then they wouldn't be bowing to the Washington consensus and neoliberalism that, you know, I think that you pretty much presumed is the solution for the economics. But I think a lot of people disagree, and a lot of them are in Germany. So I don't know if you have anything on that. Thank you.
Well, I think the caller raises a good point. Just how stable a coalition is this going to be?
Well, it's a great question, and we'll see. But I think we'll get our first hint on that when we get to the end of the formal coalition negotiations, which we're expecting will be mid-November. Then you'll have the party conferences presumably approve that coalition agreement, and then you'll go to a vote in the Bundestag, in the parliament, on the chancellor. And it's going to be very interesting to see how unanimous the support for Merkel is, particularly within the Social Democrats. There's no question, I think, that she will be elected chancellor by the Bundestag, but it's a secret vote, and you may well see the left of the Social Democrats rejecting her, not voting for her. And if that's the case, I think we're in for a very bumpy ride, and we may well not see a grand coalition last for 4 years. I think that's questionable in any case.
All right. There we must leave it, because we're here at the end of the time. Our guest, Karen Dunfried, she is a senior director for policy programs at the German Marshall Fund of the U.S. Dr. Dunfried, thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, David.
Our program here, Focus 580, in fact, all of our programming, is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. The broadcast also made possible with support from the Illinois State Geological Survey's Centennial Lecture Series. The survey presents a public lecture 8 p.m. Thursday, October 13th, in the Lincoln Hall Theater, 802 South Wright Street, on the U of I campus. Harrison Schmidt, the only geologist ever to walk on the moon, will present A Trip to the Moon and Beyond. We will break, as we do at this time, for an update on the markets and news. And when we continue, we'll be talking about poetry with Alice Fulton from Cornell University. Right now, here's the markets.
Agricultural programming on WILL is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 85 years, including real estate.